Welcome to Scaling Knowledge. Today I have a guest here, James. We're both very fascinated about the structure of knowledge and the open-endedness properties of innovation and creativity. Mm. And today we're going to, amongst others, discuss an article I wrote called Knowledge Burden or Boost, and also go into kind of Stanley's ideas around open-endedness and why greatness cannot be planned. James, do you want to start, give a brief introduction of yourself?
Yeah, sure. So my name's James. I also work at Remnote and mainly focusing on the plugin system at the moment, which we recently released an open beta for. And yeah, really glad to be here to discuss this article. So Moritz, can you give us like the main core theme of the article? What's the big idea behind it?
The article Knowledge Burden or Boost criticizes the paper The Burden of Knowledge, The Death of the Renaissance Man. And the paper is written by economists. They analyze how much innovation is happening based on how much new grads there are, like how many graduate and then start creating patents. Mm-hmm. And there are a few problems with this claim. One is that, and the claim, basically the thesis is that leads to a longer innovation cycle. So it takes longer for innovators to get to the frontier. Mm-hmm. And so the problems are, one, knowledge grows unpredictably. We cannot calculate when the next breakthrough is going to happen. Also, children can innovate. So even Elon Musk as a 12-year-old could write a computer program, sell it. And we have many more examples of that. The authors claim in the paper that this only happens after you graduate.
Mm-hmm. So basically, you disagree with the idea that there's a burden of knowledge, that people need longer and longer educational cycles in order to gain the knowledge to be at that frontier. Because, for example, you know, children can innovate. Elon Musk is a good example. That's the main idea, right?
Right. And then lastly, one other point of critique is that there's also a wrong zero-sum model where the paper and also similar papers, the other concept is called the fishing out effect, claim that there's a fixed amount of ideas. Mm-hmm. And this amount of ideas is being used up, and then suddenly there's no ideas left. I think that's also wrong. And then also in the article, I go a bit into brainstorming what might be happening instead. We can also leave that for later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So in the background of this article, there's kind of the assumption that innovation is slowing down. And they basically choose this burden of knowledge to be kind of one of the main contributing factors to this stagnation that's going on, that a lot of public intellectuals are concerned about right now. So I guess before we get into the meat of the article, which is the burden of knowledge, what's your opinion on the stagnation hypothesis? Do you think that we are stagnating in terms of scientific and technological innovation?
I think yes. It is very hard to measure, though. But we can even get an intuition of the phenomenon by just looking at the science fiction depictions in the 1950s, like 60s and 70s, where people had a much grander image of the future. They imagined us already doing space travel and were generally more optimistic. And also quantitatively, it's mostly reflected in GDP growth, total factor productivity, and similar metrics. But there's more argument or more arguments about that. I think the former aspect of this just intuition about how much innovation there has been and there's currently is like pretty clear. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I when I was thinking about this, I went back and I watched this podcast. It was between Eric Weinstein and Peter Thiel, and they were talking about the stagnation hypothesis, and they were complaining about the 1970s and what all went wrong, you know. And Peter Thiel has this good quote where he says, you know, today, if you look around in your room and you think about like what's actually different compared to the 1960s or 1970s, really the only thing that you could see visibly that's different is like computers, really, and maybe your television screen is a bit larger and a bit thinner, right? And so it seems like we've made all this progress in computer technology, but we're stagnating in other fields like physics, biology, and so on, right? But I feel like I disagree with, or maybe I'm not sure about whether we're stagnating or not, because, and this is related to the Kenneth Stanley stuff that I've been reading a lot recently, so the myth of the object and everything, because basically because of the flawed metrics that we're using. So for example, with GDP growth, it's possible for an economy to improve its GDP and to have its GDP going up, but the people living inside that economy might not have better quality of life, better like services and stuff like that. And likewise, when GDP decreases, it's not always the case. Like sometimes that's required in order to get to the next big kind of expansion of the economy, right? So sometimes things have to get worse with our metrics before they get better. And so I feel like sometimes we look at things like patent growth, like they do in this article, and they say, okay, patent growth is decreasing, or it's taking longer and longer for people to make their first paper or get published in a big journal. And we're saying, okay, these metrics are telling us everything is stagnating, therefore things are getting worse. But after reading Kenneth Stanley's stuff, he really emphasizes the point that our metrics can really deceive us and can tell us that we're going in the wrong direction, even though things are actually going really well and we're making progress. So for example, one possibility is that, you know, we kind of need to innovate a lot in like the technological space in order to open up the stepping stones and the opportunities in other sciences like physics and biology. I think it's very difficult for us to tell now without the benefit of hindsight, you know, whether we're in a period of stagnation or whether we're actually making progress, but it's just not really visible to us right now. Yeah.
I agree. I think it requires a very holistic understanding of progress. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're, as you mentioned, very narrowly looking at these precisely defined metrics and
yeah,
not seeing the forest for the trees.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so and it links into the David Deutsch stuff, which I think you're more familiar with, like with the like we're not able to predict future expansions of knowledge, right? So when we're sitting here saying, you know, we're in a period of stagnation, but tomorrow there could be some discovery, someone could create some new idea that leads to that next Cambrian explosion, as you said, of like human innovation and technological advancement. So as soon as that happens, we look back at this period and we say, oh, well, actually nothing was stagnating at all. You know, it was just that we were just waiting for someone to come up with the idea, which is just so unpredictable. And yeah, so.
Right. Although there are then also two separate systems we're looking at. One, I think, is the generation of human knowledge and innovation. And that is a very error feedback driven process where you're constantly conjecturing and falsifying and creating new ideas, throwing out old ones. And then there's the system in which that happens, which is the economy, government supervised system. And progress studies, people generally argue that the state is like slowing down this process by creating too many regulations. There's an increased amount of continually added regulations. So I think we should mentally separate these two systems somewhat and potentially see that regulations might interfere with this more open-ended process.
I see. That's interesting. I think I'll come back to that later because great. I guess we're slightly diverging from the main article. But yeah, let me ask you a couple of questions about the article itself. So the author's argument is basically that there's this burden of knowledge. I guess my first question would be kind of a simple one. You know, do you actually believe that this burden of knowledge exists, or has the author kind of exaggerated it to make a point?
Yeah, I think the point is not clearly made in the paper. And my main claim and claim against what the authors are claiming, is that knowledge is actually being continually renewed. It is becoming fewer, or the theories are becoming more fewer, deeper, and more general. Mm-hmm. And second, can also be augmented. So with the continued innovation in information technology, human-computer interaction, and so on, we can actually use much more knowledge than just the knowledge in our heads or in the researchers' heads.
Mm.
So I think these dynamics are very interesting and hard to, yeah, and also arguments against like what is happening with this burden.
So I just thought of like kind of a good analogy, but maybe it's not a good one. I guess you can tell me when I make it. But I guess your first point is like, if you imagine a young scientist, they have to gather all this knowledge. It's almost like they're climbing up a big mountain, right? And so your first argument is that the mountain that they have to climb isn't actually getting higher and higher every year. It actually gets smaller and smaller every year because we come up with new theories that are actually simpler and deeper and explain more. So our knowledge actually becomes easier to gather by these young scientists. So the mountain itself gets smaller. And then your second point is that we come up with better and better like tools for climbing mountains because we have these cognitive augmentation tools that are almost like the pickaxes and the big coats that mountaineers wear, right? When they go up a mountain, and we get better at developing those tools over time. So people actually scale the mountain faster. So would you agree with that sort of metaphor?
Yeah, that's very accurate. I think the mountaineer vehicles are becoming more and more advanced. Mm. You can basically ride this vehicle up the mountain in no time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is some of that where technology is contributing. And then also, yeah, just the theories itself, which are becoming more simpler, mm. are combined and being unified.
Mm.
And yeah, I think the analogy makes sense.
Yeah. I definitely feel like the burden of knowledge has been a little bit exaggerated, because it definitely feels like in order to innovate, you don't actually need to know the entire mountain of knowledge, right? You can use abstractions and like the high level theories we create on top of the lower level ones in order to innovate without actually having to know everything right down to the bottom.
David Deutsch also has this point in The Fabric of Reality, where it's quite amusing, where he says that you can achieve understanding without knowing you understand something.
Mm.
Where, for example, a mathematician who knows about number theory already understands Roman numerals, mm. even if he hasn't learned about it.
Mm.
And this is because the number theory, like the modern numbers, are much more of a deeper and more general theory, and thus are superior to the Roman numerals, who for the mathematician itself
mm.
are just facts basically on top of his existing knowledge.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, if you think about it, like how many working mathematicians know mathematics right down to the very foundations? Like the foundations, as far as I know, is kind of like an esoteric area of mathematics that only a few people will be really interested in, you know, to break down mathematics into the most primitive axioms and concepts. Like no one knows mathematics all the way from high level theories down to the bottom.
I think there's stark differences between fields and areas of how strong this connection needs to be to innovate.
Mm.
Where as a programmer, I think it's pretty extreme, where mm. you don't need to know compilers to write React.
Yeah.
But as a mathematician, actually, I would kind of row against that a bit, where mm. I think it makes a lot of sense to know the foundations and to have a firm structure to build upon.
Mm.
But I think the vast majority of fields are in this more like sparse graph, less hierarchical structure.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the thing is about math is that it is actually possible to know everything down to the foundation if you were really, really persistent, I guess. or at least that's my impression as someone who isn't a mathematician. But I think I learned something recently that kind of surprised me, which is that I don't think it's very common to actually prove a theorem in mathematics right down to the very like bottom, the very axioms. Like when you submit a paper, you're never expected to show literally the entire hierarchy of every single mathematical statement and theorem that you're using right down to the foundation. So I wonder how many, like, it's almost like you have like type errors, like you have in TypeScript, right? But you have them instead in mathematics. So it makes me wonder how many mistakes are out there that we just don't know about in mathematical papers, because we don't know whether they all like actually are consistent right down to the bottom. I'm not sure. I wonder if there are people listening who know more about this who can tell me, because I'd be really curious to know.
There's actually a really fascinating book which I want to interview the authors of, which is called The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone, by Stephen Solomon and Philip Fernbach, where they talk about mostly about the illusion of knowledge, where we have these like three types of knowledge, which is black box knowledge, which is like the one we just talked about, where you have these mental black boxes. You know somebody else knows it, but yourself don't. Then there's the very intimate, deep knowledge about an area. And then there's the like in between, where you have some vague knowledge about an area, but you would have to read a bit into it to like get a better grasp. And then they also talk about these recursive acceptance, I think they call it, where there's this chain of this person thinks this person not knows it, and so on and so on. And I think that goes back to your point, where you never like really, when you make a new discovery, you don't really need to go down the chain completely to the like first fundamental thing, but you actually build on top of abstractions.
Yeah, and abstractions that live in other people's minds, which is really, really interesting. Yeah, it kind of makes you think of, and this is like an article that Piotr Wozniak wrote. He's the guy, basically the guy who originally came up with the spaced repetition algorithm, which is also used in RemNote. And he wrote about this idea called society as a concept network, which is basically where he conceptualizes everyone in society as basically a neuron, and they're basically sending messages in between each other. And he really thinks of society as a whole as a kind of concept network. And this isn't like a unique idea, but I think his perspective on it is quite interesting. We should talk about it maybe in a future podcast. But
To add one small tidbit to that, Mani F, the critical rationalist, might point out that knowledge cannot only live in people's heads, so it's not it's not subsumed by psychology, but it's actually much more fundamental. It's part of philosophy or deep fabrics of reality, where knowledge can also be embodied in a tree, which is genetic knowledge, in a spacecraft, which is how do you assemble a spacecraft and fly it around. And then also most interestingly, I think, in computers and in software.
I think this is one part of the article where I maybe disagreed with you. Let me try and find it. Right. So you say the paper wrongly claims that knowledge can only be used in people's heads. And I think in the paper, what they're talking about is basically in order to innovate, people have to have knowledge in their heads, right, in order to come up with that ideas. And you say this claim is based on a false widespread belief, the idea that knowledge is a psychological phenomenon. And I felt like I kind of agreed more with the paper here, because while I think what you're saying is true, like knowledge can be embodied in different things, like for example in a cell, or you know, there's knowledge in a book or whatever, right? I think the critical thing here is like, in order for there to be an innovation, knowledge has to be inside someone's head so that they can make some kind of connection between two pieces of knowledge in their head. They have to have that like associative property, the ability to associate two new ideas in order to create something new. And that doesn't like happen I don't think anywhere except inside people's minds, right? This is like one criticism I have of like a personal knowledge management system like Rome, where you don't have flashcards available, because although you have this ability to store more things, more knowledge inside the system, it's useless unless it's in your head as well, where you're able to connect to things and come up with and create new ideas. And so I feel like fundamentally for innovation and for creativity, knowledge does actually have to exist inside your mind. Yeah.
Although it's often sufficient if it's just a pointer to somebody else's knowledge. So
right.
It's a question of to what extent does it have to exist, and also to what extent can your minds be combined? You could say in one working memory to create an idea together when you have like papers sometimes are written by like hundreds of authors. And also I kind of, that's kind of a footnote in on the article where I also sketch out an equation where you might, where you, which might help think about this phenomenon.
One other question I had was about the title of the paper you're commenting on. So the title of the paper is pretty cool. One of the parts is like the death of the Renaissance man. So do you agree like with this idea like that people are basically not going to be able to become Renaissance men or Renaissance women in the future?
Yeah, there's an interesting aspect of the paper where I hypothesized that the causation might be in the wrong direction, where the paper mostly claims that we are having more specialized education because there's a burden of knowledge. But I think might be the other way around, that we have this burden of facts because we are getting more and more specialized, where we could actually have more innovation with more Renaissance men style humans who are more educated more broadly. But the education system does not allow that, really. So I think I agree that there's a death of the Renaissance man, but I'm not sure what's the cause.
Right. Yeah, it definitely seems like the educational funnel, which kind of forces people down into the specialized route, might be to blame for it, at least partially, right?
Exactly.
I remember maybe like a couple of years ago at this point, did an interview with Andy Matushak, and I asked him, like, do you think that spaced repetition can maybe help here? Because I guess the broad claim, like the broad idea here would be that spaced repetition allows you to hold more knowledge in your head by, you know, optimizing the memorization process and stuff. So does that make it more possible for people to become Renaissance men or women, because they're able to learn more things, learn from more fields at the same time, and hold it all in their heads at the same time? He disagreed. He didn't think it was possible, but I still think there must be like I still think it's possible, really, because at least in theory you're able to hold a huge number of flashcards in your head at the same time. I think Piotr Wozniak, to come back to him, he estimated the maximum number is at around 200,000, maybe 300,000. So if you have 300,000 flashcards encoding like scientific concepts across a range of disciplines, you know, you're surely going to be able to come up with some crazy Renaissance man-esque ideas, right?
Yeah, if you want to become a Renaissance man, check out remnote.com. The best tool for knowledge management.
Yeah.
Just mentioning it.
Very good.
And yeah, James, I would love to go on to a different, like somewhat related topic, which is that of open-endedness and why you might say that greatness cannot be planned. Do you want to talk a bit more about the idea and where it originated?
Sure. So open-endedness is really interesting. It's like the property of a few systems that we can observe in real life, where the system itself doesn't really have an objective. It might have constraints within the system, but it doesn't have an objective, but it creates like these incredible things inside of it. So the like number one example that I love is of nature and evolution. Basically what Kenneth Stanley says is that the system, it has constraints, like animals must survive and reproduce. Those are traditionally seen as objectives, but he argues that this isn't actually the purpose of the system. These are just constraints, and then elements inside the system are free to like choose whatever path they want to take in order to satisfy these constraints. And then you see many different examples and strategies that the elements inside the system take in order to satisfy them. And so you just have this incredible open-ended game, which starts off with incredibly simple elements like individual cells interacting together. And then it grows out into things like human intelligence. It creates the human brain. It creates strategy and games and cooperation and all of these higher level emergent properties of the system. So yeah, open-endedness is cool, really awesome. And it's something that we don't really know a whole lot about at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you also created a video summary. So if anyone is interested in the book by Kenneth Stanley, Why Greatness Cannot Be Planned, definitely check out that.
Yeah. Yeah. So his book, it's more about like the role of objectives in society and how we kind of abuse them, and like how a better path would be to kind of emulate these open-ended systems. Nice. And instead of setting specific objectives, we just collect stepping stones, as he says, and follow our interests in order to try and get the benefits that we see of systems like evolution and stuff like that. But yeah, for the open-endedness... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
All right. For the open-endedness stuff specifically, if you're interested in that, he's got just, I think, maybe one article online where he goes into his ideas about open-endedness and implications for AI, since he's an AI researcher and stuff like that. But I hope he writes another book, and I hope it's on open-endedness, because that would just be so super cool. He must be writing another book, seeing the reaction he got from the first one, right?
Exciting.
We should ask him that, actually.
Yeah. FYI, we're interviewing him in I think like five or six days. Mm-hmm. So definitely, if you're listening to this before the interview, you can join us in the Zoom call and ask questions. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we are moderating this chat with him. Mm. And I'm also curious, or to touch on this topic a bit, I wonder if it can be generalized, or if another viewpoint is that you want a system that creates high variance, mm-hmm. where you want a system where the agents each have the unique knowledge they gain over their lifetime, and then at the end have a very diverse set of experiences and projects they build, and so on. And I think that's very similar to venture capitalists, where they invest in companies that have a high variance and it's not very, they have a high risk but high potential reward. I'm not sure if the analogy there makes sense. I'm curious what you think of this analogy, and also if it might be generalized in that way.
I think it's something that I've thought about before. So for example, if you look at people who do artificial breeding, so that's where you take populations of animals and you breed them together in order to kind of get some beneficial trait to be like to kind of spread around the population, right? One of the strategies that artificial breeders use in order to like maximize the speed and like maximize the kinds of the good kinds of adaptations that they're trying to breed for is they split the main population into many small subpopulations, and they start off by breeding just inside those small populations together, and their aim is to maximize like the variability and the variance between the kinds of genes and the kind of mutations that they're getting, and then they breed them back in between the subpopulations and so on. And the idea is that they want to like maximally preserve the difference in genes between these different subpopulations, rather than just putting them all in one big population, and then you get this kind of averaging out effect. Like if you have everyone breeding all together, then there's just kind of a big averaging out effect of the kinds of genes and the mutations that you're getting. And I think it's the same with knowledge, right? I think there's the whole thing about memes and genes and how they're kind of similar, right? So in the like intellectual sphere as well, like if you have many different groups, many small groups all attacking the same problem, you might actually solve that problem faster than if you just had one big group accumulating all the money, picking one like potential avenue and then just pursuing that one. And that's really counterintuitive, I think, for a lot of people, because they think, you know, isn't it such a big waste that we have, you know, multiple science labs all doing the same, basically all working on the same problem? Wouldn't it be better if we just pooled the money and chose the best possible strategy and then all like piled everything into that? But it's actually the opposite. You need that kind of variation in strategies and then mixing intermittently between them in order to get the best ideas, I think.
Very fascinating.
Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I haven't thought enough about the book, which is also why I'm excited to chat with them. And I also like to ask you, what do you think about this like general critique of this concept or question that comes up when people hear about it, when somebody tells you like, hey, how do you do without objectives? You need objectives. This is like a fundamental building block of every project or company. How do you give them some alternative, or how do you explain it to them?
Yeah, I think it's quite counterintuitive. It's almost like explaining to creationists that evolution is more probably correct, right? You know, it's because, you know, we're all born into a system in which we immediately go to school where we basically set objectives from day one and then live in that system for 20 years. And then, so when you tell someone the alternative, it's kind of a shock, but you only have to look at systems in nature that do this in order to kind of convince yourself that there's something there that might be true. So if you think about just the cells in a tree, they know nothing about the global growth goals of the tree. They just follow very simple rules individually, each of these cells, but they're able to solve as a whole very complex problems that you might have initially expected only a global optimizer could solve. So it's like, and it's very similar in economics as well. You have the invisible hand. Individuals just make these very simple self-interested actions, but when you scale it up to millions of people all doing this and interacting with each other, you create an economy, something that's incredibly complex and can't really be globally optimized. So when you apply that to the things that Kenneth Stanley's talking about, like learning, like your career and everything, at each stage, why not try just making very simple decisions? Is this interesting to me or is it boring? Am I enjoying this or not? Do I think this has stepping stone potential or not? And then just make decisions based on that. And you can still have like great outcomes based on that. And that would be my first like intro to the idea. And then you can like read into more about the logic behind why setting objectives can actually lead you down the wrong path, why metrics can be deceiving and deceptive. I think the first part is the one that hooks people in the most, because when they see it in nature, I think it makes it more obvious to them that it's possible to apply it to human life as well. The metaphor makes it more obvious. Yeah.
Yeah. Very fascinating. I think it also goes a bit into complex systems and agentness, where I might say that even when you have a child or maybe even like a wild animal, that they have an objective, which is like survive, become wealthy, and you don't need to, like society doesn't need to train it in any way. Where are we looking at society as a tree, or is a human a tree? So I think there's a perspective question.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And I've got to say, like, I don't actually necessarily agree with everything that Kenneth says, or at least I want some more clarification, because like certain things in the book like I've definitely questioned. Like, he really criticizes ambitious goals, ambitious objectives. That's really his critique point in this book. But he does, of course, say that, like, for modest pursuits, for small goals where you can see the light at the end of the tunnel, objectives can work, and they do work, and we shouldn't stop using them. He's really critiquing these ambitious objectives. But in my experience, I think that ambitious objectives can be really beneficial. And let me give you one example that's been on my mind. Like, for example, if you take someone who recently dropped out of school, I think it's actually really important for someone like that to set an ambitious objective, because without an objective, you're directionless, and the kinds of behaviors that you'll likely engage in when you don't have that ambitious objective are likely to be ones that don't have stepping stone potential. Like, for example, playing video games, watching YouTube, watching Netflix, eating junk food, scrolling on social media, right? Those are the things that you're likely, not all the time, but you're likely to slip into. If you have an ambitious objective, I think it gives you that boost, that motivation to engage in activities like being a producer on social media rather than a consumer, like a passive consumer, and so on. So I think objectives do actually have like a pretty important role for certain people. And I'd like to pose that question directly to Kenneth. I'd be very curious to see what he says in response to that.
Will do, will do. One of my takeaways with this book, and I think that's something I definitely want to go deeper into, is the importance of creativity and curiosity, where the point seems to be that curiosity is a very undervalued resource or phenomenon to explore this potential stepping stones. And currently they're neglected, potentially.
Currently they're what, sorry?
Neglected.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or ignored.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Okay. I mean, in order to have curiosity and creativity thrive, you need to have an environment where people are maximally free just to pursue their curiosities and what's interesting to them. And you don't really have that at school, for example, because you're being told what to do. You have the global optimizers, the people who are in charge of the curriculum and education and teachers and stuff. They're telling you what to do. So you don't have that opportunity to exercise your creativity there. Right. Like, do you agree that that's kind of the root of the problem? Like, education seems like an area we keep coming back to. Do you think it's maybe the biggest thing that is holding back creativity and that kind of thing?
For sure. In the other article, I dive deeper into that, which is called Intellectual Progress Leads to Human Progress or something like that. And in education seems to me as the main source of knowledge transfer, and the knowledge in turn is the main source of progress. So if you get education right, then I think we can effectively have the cycle of knowledge transfer where new knowledge has been created, solving problems goes back into the education system. The old stuff is thrown out, and then the new batch of students is going into the world with a bunch of creativity, curiosity, and so on. So
I'm curious, what do you think an open-ended, like non-objective driven education system would look like? What would that be?
I think it would be very project driven or project based and curiosity based. There's a university in Berlin which is very innovative in its space. It's called Code University of Applied Sciences Berlin, and there's still optimization or improvement potential, which is that it's not these are real world projects, but you are not rated on the basis of the real world outcome. So if a project becomes like a unicorn or billion-dollar startup, then you don't get an A automatically. You still have to write an amazing reflection and have a good assignment delivery. It's definitely the problem you're pointing out, that currently education is not project-based or curiosity-driven.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things that really frustrated me, is like you work on an assessment or something like that, and once you're done with it, it just goes straight in the bin. Like, once it's got a grade, it's just thrown in the bin, and you never really go back to it because it doesn't actually have real world value. When you're creating a project and you're creating it for real people living in a real world, you know, who have jobs and they have money to spend, and they're choosing to spend it on your project rather than something else. I think that's like, it's really motivating. It's real feedback as opposed to the kind of fake feedback you get in the laboratory style setup of school. And it's also like a really strong signal to you if someone pays for your service. You know, that's really telling you that you're doing something right. That should be, you know, way better to you than an A, just from a teacher who kind of has to grade your stuff and has to give you feedback, right?
Yeah. This also brings up an interesting idea, or the question of how much economic progress would we create, just looking aside from all the other benefits like curiosity and more learning, which is how much economic value could all these students from like first grade to 12th or whatever create just by like learning project based and creating a lot of, for example, digital products. I think that's not to be underestimated or not undervalued.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it would be a tough sell, because you'd have to sell this to parents in such a way that you're not saying, you know, your kid is coming to work with me in my sweatshop where they're going to be creating digital goods for other people online. Yeah, but no, I completely agree. Like, when you have more of a, it's almost like if you take it back to the idea of a tribe, right? An ancestral tribe, the way the kids learnt back then is not through like sitting in school or sitting in like a hut and the tribe leader is like lecturing to them on writing on a chalkboard or something, or like drawing or painting on the cave wall, right? Instead, they have more of like an apprentice-based approach where like the hunters are going out and the kids are like watching them and imitating them as they're doing the hunt or whatever. And when they're building the camp, they're helping out and they're watching people, how they act around each other and how they go about constructing the camp and stuff like that. So they're embedded in that real world context, real world scenario. They're immersed in it, like almost like we talk about how immersion in a foreign language is so important. It's the same in any other domain, I think. The more we can get kids and students into real world domains rather than the artificial school environment, I think it's going to be way better for society.
Yeah, I think we should tear down the idea completely where simulations can also be very effective training systems. And it's often much easier to create a simulated environment than to create a real world environment. So there's definitely some value to that system. Although I think you bring up an interesting point, which is that the idea of child labor, I think in most countries, is extremely outdated. Where back in the days, we thought of child labor as something bad because it was actual labor and children died in these factories. But today, I think what they would do is, as we mentioned, like build digital products, design websites, write code, or create something.
Well, I think the more you go over to like the knowledge-based society, the knowledge work economy, the better it becomes for the kid, because they're not like doing physical labor, which tends to be kind of like destructive to your body or have like dangers. It's risky as well. Like when you're just doing knowledge work, it's safe. It's right. Also like very rewarding and fun because it's like creative. Lots of the time it's creative as well, knowledge work. So yeah, I think that's a really good point. Like maybe we do need to completely reconsider like child labor laws. Maybe you could run on that policy in Germany and see how it goes.
Will do, will do. Sometime soon.
Yeah. All right. Well,
awesome.
This was awesome. This is a really fun conversation. Do you want to call it that?
Yeah, let's do it. Where can people find you online?
I guess on Twitter, at Expera Learning. I guess I'll put a link in the description or send it somewhere.
Yeah. Awesome. And I'm Moritz W. 42 that way. And yeah, that was exciting. Thank you so much, and looking forward to next episodes.
Awesome. Yeah, see you next time.